Welcome to Vashon 250, a local celebration of America's 250th birthday. We are looking back at what was happening at certain points in our nation, beginning with the Revolutionary War. We continue with milestones on up until modern times and comparing it all to life on Vashon Island then and now. I'm John Flora, along with my colleague, resident historian Bruce Hallman. We're coming to you from the studios of KVSH 101.9 FM, your island connection. Please plan to make us a regular part of your listening habit. Our views and commentary do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH, Voice of Vashon, or our supporters. With that introduction, it's time to talk about the Stamp Act. It has nothing to do with philanthropy, stop, whatever it's called, stamp collecting. It's all about taxes. And we're going to, it's often been referred to as taxation without representation and other things. As we reach for our tri-cornered hats, please welcome my colleague who will explain what we're covering in this episode. Professor?
Oh, thanks, John. What we're doing in this series is essentially looking at what occurred during the Revolutionary War era, sort of 1765 up to 1790s. And comparing that with what's gone on in the sweep of American history since the 1790s up into the beginning of the 21st century, and then looking at what's going on currently, particularly since the 2024 election and 2025 with the new Trump administration, and then tying that all together by looking at what's happened in the past on Vashon Island. So given that, we want to look back today at the Stamp Act, which in many ways was really the beginning of the American Revolution. And then we'll take that Stamp Act into looking at other kinds of tax revolts that have occurred over time in American history, and then look at currently how the tax codes are being changed and how tariffs are beginning to become potentially, if it gets to the Supreme Court, a source of revenue, and then look at Vashon and how Vashon is related to King County and the state of Washington in terms of taxes.
Great. So let's carry forward.
Carry forward.
It's a lot to cover.
Yeah, a lot going on. But today we're looking at the March 22nd, 1765 Stamp Act, that many historians view really as the essential impetus for the beginning of the American Revolution. The Stamp Act was an act by the Parliament of Great Britain which imposed a direct tax on the British colonies in North America and required that many, almost all, printed materials in the colonies be produced on stamped paper which came from England and included an embossed revenue stamp. That meant printed materials, including legal documents, magazines, playing cards, newspapers, any type of paper throughout the colonies had to be paid a tax in British currency, not in this sort of worthless colonial paper money. And it put an incredible burden on American colonists. The purpose of the tax was to help the British pay for military troops stationed in the American colonies after the French and Indian War, which in Europe was known as the 7 Years' War. But the colonists had never really feared an invasion from Europe, particularly by France. In fact, ultimately would turn to France as an ally during the Revolutionary War. And so they concluded that the tax was already paid for them and that they really didn't need to pay it. So that set up the tension between the colonies and the British government. And of course, for Great Britain, the tax was a way to continue to pay for the military and to continue to pay their debts from the French and Indian War.
So this was really all about, I guess to make it simple, war debt, military, as opposed to what we might think of as government today, building roads, providing housing for homeless, food banks, whatever. This is more about basic military.
Just basic defense. Yeah, defense spending. And of course, in America today, you know, defense spending is a big part of the American sort of national debt. supplanted by social programs, but it's still a significant part of the role of the federal government. And for Great Britain, you know, defense, and particularly in Europe at that time, was a primary concern. So the British wanted to raise revenue to, one, pay off their war debts, but also to keep the military at full sort of complement. So, you know, with the Stamp Act, of course, very unpopular among colonists, the majority considered it a violation of their rights as Englishmen to be taxed without their consent. I mean, this was a tax imposed by Parliament on the colonies. The colonial governments had no say in it whatsoever. And of course, in British common law and in British practice, you know, taxes were by the consent of the governors, of the governed, you know, by Parliament in Great Britain and in the colonies by the colonial legislatures. And so the slogan that comes out of this is no taxation without representation, which becomes one of the rallying cries, if you will, of the American Revolution.
As we look back on this and then, I guess, look forward, my daughter reminded me once recently as we were driving down the road, she said, "Dad, you're right." I was shocked. And I said, what was I right about? She goes, "You're right. History repeats itself." And so we continue to see this on up till today.
And I've always liked the phrase, you know, I mean, the old adage is those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. But I like the idea that history doesn't necessarily repeat, but it rhymes. You know, you get the same issues. I mean, there's different parties and there's different language and there's different sort of elements at work. But essentially, the issues don't really change. It's just the way the issues are formed and articulated and the sort of things that are motivating those issues on all sides are what shift. But essentially, the issues remain the same. And for us today, you know, this concept of the Stamp Act is still part of it. And of course, there's all kinds of reactions around the colonies. I mean, there's political reactions. Committees of correspondence are formed in most of the colonies. And that's significant because these committees of correspondence are really people in different colonies communicating with one another about what's going on. And so you're beginning to build a network of alliances within the colonies for opposition to British policies. In Massachusetts and Virginia and a number of states, you know, the colonial legislature passed resolves or resolutions opposing these taxes. The colonial newspapers are all ablaze with articles about the taxes and the resistance. Protests, some very violent, particularly against tax collectors. We don't often think about tar and feathering as being a really violent act, but, you know, consider yourself being covered with hot boiling tar and then rolled in feathers and being rid out of town either on a wagon or a rail. It's sort of like, man, you know, that's getting pretty violent. And then, of course, other things are happening that begin to create a basis for developing a revolutionary intent. The Sons of Liberty are formed in February 1776, and we'll come back and talk more about that in future shows. But the Sons of Liberty are really one of those intercolonial organizations that allow coordination and allow a common response to actions by the British government. And then in October of 1765, the Stamp Act Congress is called. And so nine colonies send representatives who come up, they meet for, I think, 13 or 14 days, but they come up with a declaration of rights and grievances. You know, 14 points that they oppose British government actions, and a declaration of their rights as English citizens, which really echoes what we'll see if, you know, almost 10 years later, 1776, with the Declaration of Independence. So this Stamp Act really becomes one of those foundational moments in leading us to the American Revolution.
And what's interesting is not everybody agreed on this stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we
picture the revolution as being this sort of all arms locked and we're all in it together. In fact, that was hardly the case.
Yeah, the American Revolution is really a civil war. And if you have a chance to watch the Ken Burns recent series called The American Revolution, you really get a sense of how contentious it was within the colonies. And, of course, the old adage, the victors write the story.
Yes.
What you often get lost in the traditional narrative of the American Revolution is how significant the opposition was, how many loyalists there were, how many left after the war, either moving back to England or moving to Canada, to Newfoundland, to other areas, or heading west. So you really had what in effect was the first American Civil War, is what we call the American Revolution.
Yeah. And so in the weeks ahead, we'll talk more about that. But it's just amazing to think that things like the Stamp Act kicked off a lot of the discussion that led to the revolution. Exactly. And somehow we came out as we did, for better or for worse. And we'll talk more about that in the weeks ahead. So, Professor, would you summarize for us where we are with the whole Stamp Act issue?
Well, sure. I mean, it's important to me to think about the Stamp Act as really the beginning of the American Revolution. I mean, there's lots of other things going on, but in terms of what it mobilized, in terms of the colonial response to the Stamp Act, really set the stage for the American Revolution. You had these sort of colonies coming together with a committee of correspondences, with the Stamp Act Congress. You had the Sons of Liberty, which were, in a sense, a little bit like the Proud Boys today. I mean, they were the bad boys of the time. They were really organizing an opposition to the British colonial governments. In many ways, the Stamp Act itself was a catalyst for pulling together the colonies for the first time in a way to have a common voice to respond to what they saw as abuses by the British government.
And would it be fair to say that that was a populist approach versus what became the legislative approach?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I mean, it was very much sort of, if you view populism as coming out of the people, that's sort of the basic meaning of populism. This was not organized by elites. Certainly elites were involved, but many of the elites, if you will, many of the business interests, many of the trade interests, many of the wealthy planners in the South, liked the colonial government. And were the colonial governments. They're the ones who were elected to office. And so in many ways, this is one of the early populist movements in the United States and results in a revolution that creates a nation based on this concept of populism. All men are created equal. So, yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
So let's take it the next step and look at American history, sort of the broad sweep of American history that sort of has echoes of what happened during this period in response to the Stamp Act. And it's sort of American history has been dotted, particularly early on, but all through American history, with the concept of no taxation without representation. And sort of the American political landscape since the Revolution have seen revolts, tax revolts, in many different forms. Particularly early on, you had revolts like Shays' Rebellion, which was an anti-tax revolt by farmers and small merchants in western Massachusetts. They basically didn't want to pay taxes. The taxes they saw as unfair, and so all they could do was attack the tax collectors. I mean, that's the people who are the front line in this. And so you begin to get resistance. You begin to get tar and feathering of tax collectors. you begin to get resistance and refusal to pay taxes. And what comes out of Shays' Rebellion, this is 1786-87, is a realization that the Articles of Confederation, which were, you know, the American government, the United States government at that time, were too weak to allow a response. The federal government couldn't respond to these tax revolts. And so it was up to the state governments, and essentially the state of Massachusetts had to put together, an army to put down this Shays Rebellion. And it sort of highlighted the need for a stronger central government. And you see that, you know, a few years later with the Whiskey Rebellion in 1791 through 1794. And this is a revolt in western Pennsylvania where farmers who, after they had harvested their crops and sort of processed their wheat and corn and grain and things, whatever they had left over, they would make whiskey. Sort of, why not?
Good, there we go.
Good sipping.
That's
whiskey.
A good Vashon idea.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, how many wineries are there on Vashon? You know, and so it's the idea that the federal government wanted to tax this whiskey that was being produced, and it was the very first tax by the new federal government on a domestic product. I mean, the government had taxed imports, they had tariffs, things like that, but this was the first attempt by the federal government to impose a tax on a domestic product. And of course, quote unquote, sin taxes have always been a part of American revenue, as generating, taxing alcohol, taxing cigarettes, you know, taxing gambling, things like that have always been a part of the American tax system. But this was the first attempt, and the farmers in Western Washington the farmers in Western Pennsylvania did not want to pay that tax. And so what ended up happening is the federal government raised an army of 13,000 troops led by the president, George Washington, the hero of the American Revolution, and they marched into western Pennsylvania, arrested a bunch of farmers, and imposed the tax. And of course, most of those farmers arrested were not convicted. You know, ultimately, most of them were pardoned. But it allowed the federal government to establish its right to impose taxes and to collect them. And then you have another tax that I think, tax revolt that I think is interesting. A few years later, 1799 to 1800, which is called the Freeze Rebellion. And this was a rebellion among Pennsylvania Dutch farmers. So these are German immigrants in sort of eastern and central Pennsylvania, who resisted a new tax, a new federal tax on property and slaves. It's often called the Window Tax Rebellion because the tax was imposed on houses, on farms, but the level of the tax was determined by how many windows you had in your home.
That's so clever.
Yes, right. Yes. Yeah, so, well, bigger house, more windows, more tax, you know. And of course, these solid German sort of farmers were just aghast that they'd have to pay tax on their property. You know, property taxes were not common at that time. And so it was a revolt, essentially, to not pay taxes that, again, was put down by the intervention of state and federal troops. And in none of these rebellions was there really much conflict between there was not much gunfire. It was just sort of the overwhelming presence of an army that sort of subdued these rebellions. But it's established very on that Americans did not like to be taxed. And when they were taxed, they were going to resist.
So, Bruce, just to be clear, you're talking a couple of different taxation rebellions that came up. This is all post-Revolutionary War. We've won the war, quote unquote. But the federal government is broke, right, and it's looking for money. The states are getting their way, starting to get their operations underway. And so you have an immediate post-Revolutionary War struggle between federal taxation, states' rights, and how that all begins to muster. And we're still dealing with states' rights today. It comes up every day in the news. So, and I don't think it'll ever go away, and that's the way the system's built. But this is the point where that starts to really shine, correct?
Sure, very much so. Yeah, you're right. I mean, that the Stamp Act was really a colonial resistance to British taxation. By the time you get the formation of the Articles of Confederation, and they obviously fail, and Shays Rebellion's part of that failure of the Articles of Confederation because they don't provide for a strong enough federal government. Then you have the adoption of the Constitution, which provides for a strong sort of federal government, and you see that strong federal government responding with the Whiskey Rebellion of 1791 and the Fierce Rebellion of 1799. And so what you get by the early 1800s is a clear establishment of the power of the federal government and the right of the federal government to impose taxes. And so it's a very important sort of shift that takes place there. And of course, those early taxes in the 1790s are largely to help pay for the American Revolution. I mean, the United States government, you know, under the Articles of Confederation and then under the Constitution, come out with this mountainous debt as a result of the Revolutionary War. And so they're constantly trying to pay for that debt. And of course, taxes is one form of paying for it. And the other form, believe it or not, are tariffs. Tariffs.
You mean those aren't new?
Tariffs are not new. And tariffs, particularly during this early Republic era, up until really the Civil War, tariffs are largely for revenue for the federal government. The economic historian Douglas Irwin, who is at Dartmouth, has sort of done a great job sort of defining the three and now moving into the fourth stage of tariffs, if you will. And the first is that sort of post-Revolutionary War up to the Civil War, where tariffs are largely for revenue and largely to fund the federal government. Now, after the Civil War, as the United States begins to emerge as an industrial power in the world, tariffs shift. And so from the Civil War up to the Great Depression, you know, tariffs are really focused on protecting American industries. And so you have this shift away from revenue to production to a shift toward protectionism in the late 19th and early 20th century. And of course, that protectionism is part of what leads to the Great Depression of the 1930s. And coming out of the Great Depression of the 1930s and World War II, tariff policies shift back to the idea not even of revenue and not of protection, but of promoting free trade. And so what we see in the post-World War II world from the 1940s up until the 2020s is American tariff policy is largely built around promoting free trade and promoting the ability of American business to work in the world without constraints. And that's a really powerful sort of building of that post-war economic world. And then we come to 2025 when we have a new administration comes in who has a very different view of tariffs and sees tariff both as protection and as revenue generating. And we're in the morass we're in right now over whether those tariffs that have been imposed are even legal. And of course, the appeals court has decided that they're not legal. And that was argued just in November before the Supreme Court. And so we're all waiting to see where the Supreme Court comes down. Are these tariffs that were imposed by the Trump administration under an International Economic Emergency Act, President Trump basically declared a national economic emergency because of the trade deficit. And the courts are going to rule whether or not that's legal. And so we may see these tariffs continue. we may see that whole tariff structure collapse. But, you know, to understand the role of the federal government and the role of tariffs as either generating revenue or generating protection is an important sort of stream that comes out of that Revolutionary War, where the government needed money to pay for the war. Two major ways to get money: tariffs and taxes. And of course, the first taxes that were imposed, you know, led to Shays Rebellion, the Whiskey Rebellion, the Freeze Rebellion. People were not happy about paying taxes.
And if you go ahead to the, I believe it was in the 70s or 80s when the state of California passed Prop 13 on property taxes, yep, it was because the people were unhappy. Yep. And that has, that's been in place a long time now. It continues to have impacts on the state of California.
Yeah.
And I've often wondered if, like everything else, that'll come up the coast someday.
Well, but it already has. I mean, that's sort of the Tim Iman tax revolt of the late 90s that sort of gutted the ferry system. That was a tax based on car tabs, and the Tim Iman initiative, I think it was 1999, was basically to reduce that car tab cost down to, $30 or something like that, I think it was set at. And, of course, who used that car tax money the most was the ferry system. And, of course, today we're seeing the results of that when the, you know, Vashon ferries are not working because they're breaking down, because those ferries were built in the 1980s and 1990s. And then with the tax revolt of 1999, no new ferries have been built, in effect, or very few have been built. And so those older ferries are starting to break down. They're reaching the end of their useful life, and we don't have any new ferries to replace them. So when you're sitting in a ferry line, think about the Stamp Act.
Yes.
Think about Shays Rebellion. Think about tariffs. Think about taxes, and how important they are for us to have what we consider basic services.
Well, the other thing that will be interesting to see as this goes through, as Trump's tariff issues go through the courts, is the role of executive privilege, or the Executive Act, where he signs all these things into place. And how legal is that? It's not a new form of management for the government. It's gone. That goes back to George Washington. Right. But how does that play into the whole mix? And we'll talk about that in future episodes, but it's an interesting question. So with that, let's wrap up our second episode. We could go on for hours here, but we have many weeks to come, and you'll be able to hear more of this as we go through it. Bruce and I invite you to join us each week for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island heritage. And our programs are available on the Voice of Vashon website at voiceofvashon.org. Go to the site and click on your choice of saved programs. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic, please drop us a note to Vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. That's Vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. Vashon250 is a presentation of Voice of Vashon, your island connection. The show is produced by Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services. NACM serves business, credit, and finance departments across the Fruited Plain. We appreciate their support. And with that, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.